Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Thursday, June 6th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be gathering around the virtual water cooler to talk about what we've been up to. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
All right, Jacob, what have you been up to recently?
I'm not sure what thing I've been up to, but I feel like I need to briefly speak about Scott Wampler. He was a film critic, film writer, podcaster. He worked for Slash Film as an editor, and he passed away last week. It was very sudden, and everyone knew him is still pretty much in shock over it. And I feel like if you are a Slash Film Day listener, there's a chance you were aware of Scott, either from his work on Birth, Movies, Death as a writer and editor, or his work on the KingCast podcast, or just the various places where he would pop up, especially on Twitter, where he was extremely welcome personality. I know people who aren't even film people who followed him because his Twitter feed was such incredible chaos. And I worked with him on some side projects outside of Slash Film, and I got to know him really well over the past few years. And I wrote about this on Slash Film, so we'll put that in the show notes, my thoughts on what he brought to our industry and why he was valuable. But I just wanted to say a few words about how I thought he was a very special person, and I thought that he was so smart and so funny, and his online persona of this chaos thriving, you know, just energetic madman was 100% accurate, but in person he was also such a good listener, and he was so kind, and the fact that all these aspects existed within one person points to what he was as a human, but also I think it points to why he was so good at what he did. For a guy who was so sharp and was so unafraid to pull punches and would always call bullshit out when it was there, he really took the time to understand other people, understand what he was watching or reading, and led this combination of empathy combined with aggression that I think is that really defines what his style was as a writer, critic, and podcaster. And I kind of wish that more people, myself included, could take a page from that. Just the absolute attention to care. He never said anything irresponsibly, but he was also unafraid to be honest. And Yeah, I just wanted to just say, like, he'll be missed greatly.
Yeah, seriously, man. I mean, you had a much closer relationship with him than I did. I only met him a couple of times, like at cinema cons and stuff like that over the years. But yeah, he was always like incredibly nice to me, and he had no reason to be. And he was just, yeah, just seemed like a really, really solid guy. Obviously, the outpouring of support and love and remembrances and stuff has really proven that like a million times over. But yeah, it's just like a devastating loss for the film community and so many you know, even filmmakers and stuff have spoken out about it and expressed their remorse over the loss of like a really, really vital voice in the film community. So he was like, back when I was checking Twitter obsessively every day, he was like one of the few accounts that I was actively looking forward to seeing what Scott said about any different situation. And it was obviously mostly just pure anarchy, chaos type of stuff that you mentioned. But yeah, what a real light in our little world and community. So yes, Scott will certainly be missed. Thank you for saying that, Jacob. And I encourage people to read Jacob's article at Slash Film. Like he said, I'll link that in the show notes because there's much more there. And go check out Scott's work, including the King cast and all of his written stuff. I mean, there's just such a vibrant personality there. So, okay, let's get into what we've been reading, Jacob. I read a book recently called Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. This seems like something that you might have come across. It was published in 2011. Is there any chance that you've beaten me to the punch here and already read this book?
I have not read this, so please go on.
It gets into his early home life, which I had no idea that Bogart was like he was like born into wealth. His mom was an artist and she, I want to say designed the original Gerber baby. Like, Bogart himself was not the model for the original Gerber baby. I think there's like a rumor or some sort of misinformation going out around about that. That is not true, but, his mom was like a really famous, accomplished artist, back in the day. And so he was born into some pretty significant wealth and came up, you know, in like the private school community and all that kind of stuff. And then eventually sort of stumbled his way into acting. He had a really complicated relationship with his mom that I had no idea about. And he also had a handful of marriages that I didn't know about. And this book then basically, after it transitions from his early life, it goes movie by movie throughout his entire career. I found a lot to enjoy about this as a fan of Humphrey Bogart, obviously. This book is not necessarily like the dishiest when it comes to stories. I remember reading somewhere that Bogart and his old pal, Peter Lorre, who's another great character actor, once got so drunk that they somehow stole a safe from a restaurant and like abandoned it in the street outside. And that story is not in this book. And I'm wondering if it's because the author couldn't prove that it actually happened, or if he just sort of stayed away from the more sort of salacious kind of stories that are floating around out there about Bogart, because he was a big, big drinker. And so there are a lot of stories, I'm sure, that are not in this book, but there are still some fun things to be found in here and some amusing things too, especially like there would be times where Bogart would be working on movies that he wasn't necessarily a fan of, and 6 o'clock PM would occur. And like the second 6 PM happened, he would have a drink in his hand and he would just walk off the set, because in his contract, he had stipulated like my day ends at 6 PM. Like, I don't care what else is going on. So yeah, there's just like some interesting stuff in here that I'd never heard. So if you're interested in learning more about one of the great cinematic icons, Tough Without a Gun is the name of the book. What have you been reading, Jacob?
Yeah, I've been... Last time I was on the show to talk about water cooler stuff, you recommended Slow Horses to me, the Apple TV Plus show. And I think I may have mentioned on that show that I wanted to read some of the books first before I got into the show, because they've been on my list for a bit. So that's what I did. I read the first few books, which covered the first few seasons, and I kept on reading. So the book series is actually called the Slough House series, whereas the TV adaptation takes the name of the first book, Slow Horses, and makes it the name of the show. So I've read the first 6 Slough House books now, and there are 8 of them, so I'll hopefully be caught up entirely on it soon. And yeah, these are absolutely terrific, and I think that the show may be one of the best adaptations of anything I've ever seen in terms of capturing the tone and atmosphere of the books. And I think they make a lot of really smart adaptation choices. The show makes Gary Oldman's character, Jackson Lamb, this sort of, you know, disgusting slob spy, a bit more sympathetic, and it makes the characters who work under him a bit more heroic. The books somehow, if you think Jackson Lamb is a nightmare in the TV show, he's worse in the books. And if you think that his agents are often incompetent in the show, they're worse in the books. So, but I think that those are right choices for a TV show. And I really enjoy the books. The sense of humor is drier. The action's a bit more mundane, so to speak, but in a way that I think works. And I you know I'm just kind of obsessed with both the show and the books now. I mean, I've always enjoyed genre stories of failure. I mean, this is a weird comparison, but I always think about the Adult Swim animated series Venture Brothers, which is set in a world of super spies and superheroes and daring do and adventure, but follows a cast of characters who are complete and utterly miserable and are terrible at their jobs and are just deeply sad people. So if you, so I don't want to, I don't, you know, it's a very different thing. I think it's maybe one of my favorite things, Ben, which is high stakes genre stories about people who are not good at their jobs. I think that was something I've learned to really enjoy.
That's awesome. Yeah, man. I'm really glad you're enjoying those books. I've not dug into any of them yet, but I love the show so much that I might have to go back and read those. What else have you been reading?
Yeah, I mentioned this last time too, but I've officially read all of the Three Body Problem series by Shishin Liu, or I guess more accurately, A Remembrance of Earth's Past is the actual name of the book series. Three Body Problem is just the name of the first book, and a Game of Thrones type situation, you know, they, and like a Slow Horse situation, that took the name of the first book for the TV show. And I really like the Netflix show. I think it's a really good adaptation of these books. And I know one thing that made people roll their eyes was when the showrunners talked about how we got to make sure we get season two because that's where it gets really good. And a lot of people were like saying like, oh, if so we got to sit through a bad first season to get to the good stuff. And I get that reaction, but now having read the complete trilogy, they're right, because the first book really is just a kind of moving things into place and establishing the world, whereas books two and three are utterly massive and terrifying and set me into some existential spirals when I consider some of the concepts you're going through.
Wow.
And now Netflix has confirmed that they're going to finish the show. They're going to adapt all of the books. I can breathe easy because there is stuff in books two and three that is just utterly unforgettable. And I can't wait to see it realized. Just the scope and the darkness of those books. It's not dark in the, you know, in an edgy way of like, you know, it's not like it's violence, or it's about like, you know, just being dark for the sake of dark. It's like really digging deep into like the idea of what it means to be the extremely rare living thing in a vast universe and how easy it is for that to be snuffed out. And the book does a really remarkable job of making you think about that while you're dealing with an alien, you know, invasion story. Mm. So yeah, those books. So if you've read the first book and thought it was okay, which I know a lot of my friends did, they stopped after the first book. I think the second and third books are like remarkably good and are absolutely like going to make for great television. I'm very excited.
So I still have not watched the first season of the show yet. And now I'm kind of wondering, because that's the refrain that I've heard a bunch of different times. It's like, once it gets to books two and three or whatever, like the story really, really ramps up in an interesting way. And now I'm kind of wondering, like, maybe I should hold off until the show actually tackles that material and like all of the seasons exist and then catch up in one fell swoop. Cause I don't know if you've experienced this, but like House of the Dragon is coming back for season two, right? Like pretty soon, like this month, maybe next week or something like that. And like, I barely remember things that happened in the first season. It feels like that show came out like what, a couple years ago, season one or something. So that feels like a more frequent occurrence these days, where shows that we love, or get temporarily obsessed with, take huge breaks. And I know the strikes had a lot to do with the break in that particular case too. Or actually, I think I want to say House of the Dragon was filming in the UK, so they weren't necessarily as impacted as some other productions. Anyway, that's beside the point. The point is, I just wonder if like maybe I should wait, because you recommended me watch the show, Jacob. But having read these books now, what do you think my timeline should be?
I definitely think that when season two drops, you should probably maybe binge the first two seasons. And okay. I think the first season actually is very good. It's sometimes really good. And it actually makes a lot of improvements on the first book, because Shishin Liu has an Isaac Asimov thing going on where he has almost no characterization in his books. The characters are very much mouthpieces for like the scientific ideas and the sci-fi ideas. And the show fixes that by making, by literally adding character to the characters. And I'm okay with that in a book. Like, I'm actually okay like with the way the books are written, that I can, that they lean entirely on concepts and plot. But the show vastly improves on the book in that it makes you actively care about the people. So it definitely is it's totally watchable right now. Like, you could watch season one right now and enjoy it. But I think if you had season two to get into right afterward, I think we'd be having a very different conversation.
Okay. So what else have you been reading? You've been reading one more thing, right?
Yeah, I'm making my way through D-Day by Anthony Beevor. Beevor is one of those writers, if you ever walk through the nonfiction section of a bookstore and you hit the World War II section, you've seen his books up there for sure. He's written books about the Battle of Stalingrad, about the final battle for Berlin, and naturally D-Day. He's one of the big World War II historians. And, I've always been, naturally I know the basics of D-Day, and I've seen, movies that are set during the battle, and I know the basic shape of Operation Overlord, and, this is where the Allies invaded Nazi-occupied France in World War II, and, essentially turned the tide of the war. But to have it all laid out, to have a book this detailed, meticulous, explaining, what was going on each front, on each part of the invasion, how Dwight D. Eisenhower, commanded and planned it. It's like overwhelming. The amount of information in this book is like makes my head spin. I can only read it for like a chapter at a time because I'm trying to comprehend being in charge of something this massive and having it actually work despite how much actually did go wrong. And it's not like a fast, speedy, easy read. You kind of have to really commit to this book, but if you're like me and you have increasingly dad-like tastes in your 30s, I can absolutely recommend D-Day if you just want to like really get into the nitty-gritty of how a military operation actually functions on like a granular scale.
When you're talking about the scope of understanding, like trying to wrap your head around being in charge of something that big, it reminded me of the Napoleon book that you're telling me about. Are there any similar vibes between the two, or have you not drawn that connection?
Other than them both being nonfiction historical books, they're very different authors. I think that, and also the Napoleon book is operating from a lot of sources far removed, whereas Beevor is able to like write from a lot of firsthand sources. So there's a lot of stuff in the Napoleon book where it's like, we think this happened, or we think it's maybe the case. Whereas in D-Day, it's like, this is a thing that literally happened. There were eyewitnesses and they talked about it. So, like I said, I love historical nonfiction as it is, and all different flavors of it. But since Beevor is writing about stuff that, happened when people were alive to put it down, on audio and on video, and some of the sources are probably still alive, it definitely lends to a case of like, you don't have to use your imagination when you read his work. You just have to just listen to the facts.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, cool. So the book is called D-Day by Anthony Beevor, if you want to check that out. Let's take a break and then we'll get back into what we've been watching.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
You've got enough on your plate. Mundane meals shouldn't be one of them. Get an endless variety of the freshest, best-tasting food from award-winning chefs delivered to your door with Cook Unity, all at a fraction of the cost and time you're spending now. Take a load off and leave your meal prep to Cook Unity. Affordable food crafted by award-winning chefs delivered straight to your door. Go to cookunity.com/podcast or enter code podcast before checkout for 50% off your first week.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
At Nutrafol, we don't just help your hair, we help your body grow it. Because it's never just about your hair. It can be your job or your deodorant or your lunch or just normal life. That's why our whole body approach targets the key root causes of hair thinning. Discover your root causes and why we're the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement brand at Nutrafol.com. That's Nutrafol.com. These statements have not been approved by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease paid for by Nutraceutical Wellness, Inc.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month?
They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
All right, Jacob, I watched a movie called Three Coins in the Fountain. This is from 1954. It's a rom-com set in Rome. And there's a tradition that if visitors throw a coin into the famous Trevi Fountain in Rome, that means that they'll return to the city again one day. And that idea kind of factors into the plot of this movie a little bit. And the film follows three American women living in Rome, and it tracks their romantic entanglements. And one of them is an assistant to a novelist and falls in love with him. Another one gets involved with one of her coworkers. And the third is the most interesting because she falls for a local prince who is known as a womanizer. And this woman, who's played by Maggie McNamara, she's a real Audrey Hepburn type, I thought. She does that thing that guys are often depicted doing in movies like this, where she learns all about this prince's habits and pretends to love all the same things that he does in order to get close to him. And I just thought it was really rare that you see a female character in that position of deception, I guess, that in a film like this. So that was a pleasant reversal of my expectations. I had no idea that was coming. And, you know, when I think about romantic comedies, so often in my mind, it starts with When Harry Met Sally. And then I go back and, you know, I'm reminded over and over again, watching these movies from like the 30s, 40s, and 50s, that like these tropes have been around for a long time and remixed in different forms. And like the, you know, the sort of like fast talking Cary Grant, Katharine Hepburn style movies laid so much of the groundwork for what we consider to be, you know, these modern genre tropes or whatever. And it's just interesting to see one of those tropes remixed in a different way, you know, from way back in 1954. So the reason that I watched this movie in the first place, Jacob, is do you know the film Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, the John Hughes movie?
Oh, yeah,
really well. Okay, so there's a part where the characters are on a bus, and Steve Martin's character, I think John Candy's character, says like, hey, let's sing a song or something, like trying to sort of drum up some connection between all these disparate folks on this bus. And he's like, anybody know a song? And Steve Martin's like, oh yeah, I got one. And he starts singing Three Coins in the Fountain. And like, it's, and nobody else joins in. Everybody like turns at the same time and looks at him like, what the hell is the song that you're singing? And that's a Frank Sinatra song that I think was performed for this movie. And so then in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, John Candy saves him by basically like breaking out into the Flintstones theme song, and everybody sings along, and Steve Martin just kind of feels like an idiot. But I had no interaction with that Frank Sinatra song and didn't even know that it was based on a movie. I just thought it was like a funny thing from Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. But I was scrolling through AMC on my cable package and saw, hey, Three Coins in the Fountain. That's a real thing. I guess I better check that out. So it was a pleasant experience. Not like the most inventive thing you'll ever see, but enjoyable nonetheless. I also watched a movie called Armor of God from 1986. This is a Hong Kong action movie written and directed by Jackie Chan. I think he co-wrote, directed, and stars in this movie. What's your relationship like with the Hong Kong movies of Jackie Chan, Jacob? Have you like done the deep dive into all of those, or like picked your spots here and there? What's your Jackie Chan diet been like over the years?
I'm far from an expert on the early Jackie Chan stuff. I've seen most of his stuff from the 90s onward, but other than, you know, the first Police Story, I am woefully underwatched on these early ones. I know I need to get around to it because everybody I know who likes them is pretty much obsessed with them.
Yeah, especially Police Story 2. Like, if you've seen the first one, just dive into that one because, man, it's really, really entertaining stuff. So Armor of God is free on Tubi right now. So if you want to watch it with ads, you can check it out there. But it's basically, what if Jackie Chan did Indiana Jones? And that's a really intriguing premise to me because I love Indiana Jones. He plays a treasure hunter who has to basically steal or locate a bunch of items of like legendary armor that are known collectively as the Armor of God for this cult who has kidnapped his ex-girlfriend. And he and this girlfriend and a friend of his were in a band back in the day, but now they've all gone their separate ways. And he has become this like sort of legendary adventurer, and he has to track down the pieces of this armor. And the movie begins with a scene that is like incredibly basically just a straight ripoff of the opening of Raiders of the Lost Ark. And then the movie slows way, way down. And I was like, oh no, have I made a huge mistake? Is this not going to be a good or enjoyable experience? Because basically like there's a 15 or 20 minute sequence in the very beginning of the movie that's really entertaining. And then there's just this huge chunk where it just like takes its time and like all of the adventure stuff goes away. There's like one car chase in the middle of the movie. And I was like, well, I guess this movie is going to be a bust. And then the final 30 minutes kicks in and like it makes the whole thing pretty much worthwhile. He scales this mountain layer and infiltrates where the cult is, and then just gets into some of the most insane hand-to-hand combat stuff you've ever seen in your life. And there's one point in the movie where he like rips open his jacket and he's got like strapped a bunch of sticks of dynamite to himself. And in that classic Jackie Chan inspired by Buster Keaton kind of way, he like tries to light one as a bluff and then like accidentally can't put it out. It like accidentally really lights it for real and then can't put it out. And he's just like throwing sticks of dynamite left and right. And the layer is exploding and just like all sorts of fun physical chaos is breaking out around him. So I would recommend maybe checking this out if you're a big Jackie Chan fan. It's hard to recommend the movie as a whole though, because that middle section is like so slow and frankly pretty boring. But I don't know, if you're like, if you need that dopamine hit of like, I just want to see Jackie Chan doing awesome stuff, maybe this is one of those rare occasions where like it might actually be better to just check out YouTube clips, like compilations and stuff of Armor of God, instead of sitting through the entire movie. So that would be my recommendation. But the film is Armor of God. It's available on Tubi right now. What have you been watching, Jacob?
Well, this podcast should be going up right after the embargo break, so I can talk about House of the Dragon Season 2. I've seen the first four episodes. My review should be live on slashfilm.com right now, if you're listening to this as the podcast comes out. House of the Dragon Season 2 is more House of the Dragon, and I like House of the Dragon a lot, so therefore I like Season 2 a lot. Ask me a question about it.
Well, are there more small council meetings?
There are so many small council meetings, Ben. I've been on the record about small council meetings being my favorite part of Game of Thrones. My favorite part of House of the Dragon is when everybody sits around a table and glowers at each other and pushes each other's buttons and tries to plan or avoid war. And I guess that's one of the key things that's maybe a little bit different about Season 2, is that Season 1 was like at a sprint. It, you know, covers, you know, decades in those first 10 episodes, and sometimes, you know, years have passed between episodes, and they had to recast some of the leads halfway through the season because the actors were no longer, you know, the right age to play them. Whereas after that sort of mad dash sprint of Season 1, Season 2 kind of does Game of Thrones thing where it slows down and it enters into a slow burn mode, and much of the first chunk of the season is everybody sort of looking at the events of the ending of Season 1 and being like, oh no, what do we do next? And a lot of meetings, a lot of whisper conversations, a lot of people trying to avoid war. And then does a Game of Thrones thing where at some point in the season, in the episodes that I've seen, all that slow burn quickly ignites as, you know, things get very brutal and very big very quickly. So it's very funny to me that the first season kind of carved out its own identity, at least in my mind, by being so fast-paced and by leaping through the years. And that once it's comfortably established itself as being, hey, I know we live in the shadow of Game of Thrones, but we're our own thing, Season 2 kind of leans onto what made the best season of Game of Thrones work, which was the methodical moving of chess pieces leading to, you know, those violent collisions that everybody talks about So season two, in its own weird way, is more like Game of Thrones than ever. But since I think it established itself as being different enough in season one, it can kind of get away with emulating it. Does that make sense?
It does. And honestly, you're saying all the right things to me, because I've frankly not been super excited about the return of the show, just because I thought it was a lesser than show than Game of Thrones. And like, I didn't really engage with the characters in the same way. There wasn't like the Tyrion Lannister character that I really fell in love with. I feel like the show really wants Matt Smith's character to stand in for that type of archetype and be like, oh yeah, this is the guy that you love to hate kind of thing. And I didn't really find myself like locked in with the characters in the show as much as I did with Game of Thrones. And maybe it's because of that pacing that you're talking about in season one. So I'm actually like, it's music to my ears that you're saying the show slows down a little bit. I think a lot of people might be disappointed to hear that, but I think you and I are so aligned on like what we like about Westeros and this world and everything that like that actually sounds pretty good to me. So like, minimize the dragon action and kick up the small council meetings, and I'll be much more pleased than I think the average watcher will be. But
yeah, I will say it's just my criticism of the show as a whole is that like I like Rhaenyra and I like Daemon and I like Otto Hightower and I like Alicent, but it's not like Game of Thrones where the characters are like startlingly alive. Like they're like, I felt like I knew Tyrion. I was so on board with Jon Snow's quest. I wanted those Stark kids to survive and thrive. I wanted Brienne to become a knight. And I really connected with the characters in Game of Thrones in real direct emotional ways. Like, God, I loved hating Cersei. I loved hating Tywin. Mm-hmm. And I think by design, the shades of gray of House of Dragon, where like there's no, where like the evil versus good is even less defining in Game of Thrones, where like everybody kind of has their own point and the violence occurs from so much misunderstanding and messiness, that I have a hard time fully latching on to characters in a way that where I feel like genuine affection for them. But I'm always interested in them. I'm always interested in their choices. I want to see what happens to them. But there's yet to be a character where I am like, oh my God, I would die for them like I would for Arya Stark. Mm-hmm. So that's still the weakest part of the show, but I do think that the plotting in House of the Dragon is really top notch. And as long as you're willing to accept that these characters are always going to be interesting, if not beloved, then I think that I'm able to get on board with what the show is selling in season two. Like I said, I've seen the first four, which is half of the season, and I will say that when the screeners ran out, I was extremely pumped for what comes next. I was I'm very much on board for what the show is selling in season two. I'm trying to avoid spoilers here, as you can tell.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so the show, season two premieres on HBO on June 16th, I think is the actual date.
June 17th, actually.
Oh, June 17th. Okay, cool.
June 17th, it'll be airing on HBO and streaming on Max.
Okay, excellent. So mark your calendars for that. What else have you been watching, Jacob?
I'll talk about two shows at the same time, Jeopardy Masters and the new season of Top Chef, and very different shows other than both being, I guess, game show, reality show based. Jeopardy Masters is the primetime Jeopardy spinoff where they bring back, the absolute best players the past few years and have a massive showdown for a massive prize of like $500,000 for the winner. And, they do it like a tournament where they start with six players and whittle them down until a final three. And this season of Jeopardy Masters is so good. And I talked about Jeopardy in the past. I don't need to go long. But it's very exciting to watch that James Holzhauer, who has been the nearly unbeatable Jeopardy player, the guy who kind of rewrote the meta of how you play Jeopardy. He's been steamrolling in special tournaments like this. And finally, other players have sort of watched how he played closely enough and are able to really challenge him, which means it gets really tight and exciting. Meanwhile, the new season of Top Chef, it's still Top Chef. I love Top Chef. It's my favorite reality competition show. Like 16 professional chefs put to the gauntlet of doing various challenges, trying to cook the best food, getting whittled down one by one. And over the years, Top Chef winners, contestants have actually had their careers made by the show, and it actually has it matters in the real world. So it actually has the stakes feel very real and personal. I've always liked the show. I think it's better, honestly better than ever, but I definitely think that the current era of the show, the past 5, 6, 7 years, is where the show has been at its best. But the reason why I want to talk about both these shows at the same time is that Both have undergone host changes. I mean, when Alex Trebek passed, there was that, you know, very big search for a new host, all the controversy associated with Jeopardy. Eventually, they settled on Ken Jennings, you know, former champion, as the full-time host of Jeopardy and all Jeopardy specials. He used to share, you know, hosting duties with Mian Bialik, and she was, you know, released from that. Now it's all Ken. Meanwhile, Padma Lakshmi, who has hosted, has been the host of Top Chef since season 2, which is season 21, she has stepped away and been replaced by Kristen Kish, who is a professional chef and former Top Chef champion. So now both these shows are being hosted by people who famously were champions, who are like examples of people who thrived on the show and won on the show and were known to fans. And somehow this makes them connected to me because it leads to them having similar vibes, which is Alex Trebek felt like this godlike figure who had all the answers and just felt like, oh, even though Alex Trebek didn't have all the answers, he was playing, his character was that he was the unapproachable, unimpeachable, you know, god of Jeopardy. Similarly, Padma Lakshmi over on Top Chef, her approach was, you know, very distant, you know, very like above it all in a way that I think really worked. She felt more like an icon than a person. Mm-hmm. And now Jeopardy and Top Chef are hosted by people who feel like people. Ken Jennings is more naturally funny and loose, and he sort of cracks wise more often. And he really has the vibe of somebody who gets all the jokes, gets all the references, and understands the pain of being on the podium. And similarly, Kristen Kish over on Top Chef, she seems more empathetic. She's funnier, and she's always bringing up references of, oh yeah, I know how you're feeling right now. And it's led to both shows having different vibes, not worse vibes, not better vibes, but different vibes. And I want to know if you could think of a similar thing, like if this is like a singular event, like when the fans or the contestants sort of take over a thing. I'm reminded of how when George Lucas, you know, sold Star Wars, suddenly people who grew up with Star Wars are suddenly making Star Wars. And now people who participated on Jeopardy are running Jeopardy. People who participated on Top Chef are running Top Chef. And I'm curious about your thoughts on this as being something that how all things change or evolve.
Yeah, that was exactly where my thought was going. This whole time that you're talking, I was just thinking about, you know, like Ryan Coogler and Jordan Peele and like these people who have come up, you know, under the Spielbergs and Lucases of the world and Camerons and whoever, and have now sort of managed to synthesize those influences into their own language and like pay homage in interesting ways. Like Jordan Peele with Nope is very clearly throwing back to a Spielberg type of vibe, but it feels like his own thing. And that all of that was just like spinning through my mind as soon as you were talking about that. So like, obviously my mind is going to go to film first. Outside of the world of film, I would have to think about that a little bit more, but yeah, in terms of like, the worlds that we know best, that was definitely where my mind went.
Yeah. Well, I like both shows. I think that if you're not a Top Chef fan or a Jeopardy fan, that's fine. But yeah, I'm very much enjoying the direction of both shows, and I think both hosts really work. So thumbs up for me.
Excellent. Okay, and then what else have you been watching?
I think this was discussed at length already on the show, but I just want to mention I have seen In a Violent Nature, the new art house slasher film, for lack of a better term. And I'll add my voice to the chorus of, I know Chris loved it, I know BJ loved it, but yeah, In a Violent Nature is great. It is one of the most unique and interesting horror films I've seen in some time. And I just wanted to say, like, you avoid trailers. If you're a real slasher film aficionado, if you like really understand the language of those films, I think you're going to really get a kick out of this movie and what it does for the form. I had a great time with it.
Yeah, definitely go back and listen to last Friday's episode of the show. BJ spoke with the writer-director Chris Nash, and BJ and Chris and I talked about that. So if you're just joining us for the first time, we definitely have a lot more about In a Violent Nature on Slash Film Daily. All right, I think that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find much more about everything we talked about at slashfilm.com. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about this show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.
You've got enough on your plate. mundane meals shouldn't be one of them. Get an endless variety of the freshest, best-tasting food from award-winning chefs delivered to your door with Cook Unity, all at a fraction of the cost and time you're spending now. Cook Unity offers hundreds of meals prepared by their roster of all-star chefs. Simply choose from their innovative variety or let them surprise you. Menus are updated weekly, and new chefs are always joining the team, so you'll have fun discovering new favorites while avoiding the dreaded dinner rut. No cleanup or meal planning. Just easy and effortless meals delivered fully cooked that heat up in as little as 5 minutes. Speaking of easy, Cook Unity is flexible and commitment-free. Skip deliveries, pause, or cancel anytime. Take a load off and leave your meal prep to Cook Unity. Affordable food crafted by award-winning chefs, delivered straight to your door. Go to cookunity.com/podcast or enter code podcast before checkout for 50% off your first week.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month?
They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.